last week's address by Pope Francis, world leaders are gathering at the United Nations this week to go about the process of setting strategic goals for the body for the coming 15 years.
The goal setting comes at a time when world tensions are rising thanks to the ongoing refugee crisis in the Middle East and Europe, and Russia's recent efforts to exert its influence in Eastern Europe. Thomas Weiss is a longstanding expert on the work of the UN and has helped to devise some key principles at work in international relations. He currently teaches international relations at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and he's with us in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, your 2012 book took a look at what problems were then facing the United Nations. And one of the key issues you wrote about was that often state sovereignty dictated the solutions the body pursued. Has that changed at all in more recent years?
No, state sovereignty after Westphalia is either 365 years young or 365 years old. In fact, one could almost argue that following the recurrence of what we used to call the Cold War, that we may be back to even more sovereign states. And with Europe, which at one time seemed to be moving in the direction of perhaps not supranational, but anyway, something beyond the nation state, now seems to be moving backwards with the onslaught of refugees and, of course, the currency crisis.
Well, and one could make the argument that that was happening even before the onslaught of refugees. What would you say is the cause for this sort of recurrence towards sovereignty trumping everything else?
Well, the UN Charter Article 2 specifies that all states are equal and all states are sovereign, and there's only one occasion in which they are not, and that happens to be when the Security Council makes a decision. However, there are lots of other passages in the Charter which relate to human rights, which obviously create problems for sovereign states. And there are other things like globalization, trade, Ebola, and a few other items that suggest that what Kofi Annan called problems without passports are facing us squarely every day. And so there's this irony in which states are still flexing their sovereign muscles. At the same time, there are more and more life-threatening problems that require states to cooperate.
Is it oversimplifying things to say that these problems are the proverbial square peg in the round hole?
I think that's a perfect description. It's not simplification at all. So what we have is a series of rather narrowly framed, short-term responses to a set of problems that require making calculations about the common good, going beyond one's navel, and a longer-term perspective that requires, if not the entire globe, a huge number of very important players.
And this seems linked to a concept called the responsibility to protect. Can you explain that idea and why this is an especially important principle at this point in time?
As I said at Marquette yesterday, you may dismiss everything I have to say because I had something to do with creating this as the research director of the commission that hatched the principle. But the responsibility to protect basically says that there are sovereign states, but one of a sovereign state's responsibilities is to its own population. And therefore, if a sovereign state is unable or unwilling or is actually the perpetrator of mass murder and ethnic cleansing, their sovereignty is temporarily – it kind of evaporates. And at that point in time, the responsibility to protect and otherwise assist war victims and populations under duress devolves to the international community of states. And that's supposedly where the Security Council comes in and overrides or – yes, overrides these temporary sovereignty that's been set aside in order to come to the rescue of those civilians who are threatened by the regime or by the regime's inability to take care of them.
Are there examples of situations where this has either been put to work as the responsibility to protect or under a different name?
Well, the responsibility to protect, the report actually came out in 2001, the end of 2001, but it reflected a whole series of circumstances and crises in the 1990s, beginning with the aftermath of the first Persian Gulf War, where Kurds, amongst others, were under duress, and a coalition of the willing led by the United States came to the rescue. Throughout the 1990s, Somalia, what didn't happen in Rwanda, what some people felt happened too soon in Kosovo, laid the groundwork for the commission. The commission's report was published in 2001, and at the 60th anniversary of the United Nations in 2005, the 153, I think it was, heads of state and government who showed up approved the principle that, in fact, there is a responsibility to human beings who were caught in the throes of armed violence. Since that time, that is 2005, the Security Council has actually referred to the responsibility to PREC on numerous occasions. Undoubtedly, the main illustration was Libya in 2011, in which the term was used in the resolution, both in the resolution to implement a whole series of measures short of military force, and then with resolution 1973 to begin the air war against Gaddafi and his regime.
Is it the norm at this point, though?
Well, if you were in my graduate research seminar, I would say, well, what do you mean by norm? Because there are two really important senses of norm. One is this is what we should do, a kind of ethical, moral sense. And then there's a second, actually more statistical notion that there's a normal curve, and this is what most, in this case, most states, most people, most NGOs think most of the time. The responsibility to protect, I would say, is very close to being both of those norms, but it's still highly contested in certain contexts. You might expect that Zimbabwe and Sudan and a host of other countries are not all that fond of the idea because it implies they should be taking care of their populations, and if they don't, somebody might come to their rescue.
Sovereignty is not something nations are willing to give up easily.
No, they certainly don't, and that includes Sudan, and it also includes the United States. This is not nobody has a monopoly on wisdom in this arena.
Well, and do you think responsibility to protect might figure into a solution to the ongoing European refugee crisis, or is this something outside of that realm?
The problem with the European crisis is, are we talking about what's happening in Europe, or are we talking about the places that are sending these folks? Clearly, the only longer-run solution to this problem is to have a modicum of stability in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen. But that's not exactly going to happen tomorrow morning. And so I suspect that there will be no rush to take care of military intervention in Syria. We've abandoned Iraq and Afghanistan, and so that the responsibility to protect is kind of an afterthought at this juncture. It seems like the more sort of emergency responses are going to be related to how to find some housing, and meaning which countries are going to house these folks.
Well, and is there a more active role for the UN in this crisis?
Actually, the UN is already trying to process refugees both in the countries of asylum. One should not forget that even though there's this invasion, so to speak, of Europe, that the vast majority of these refugees are still in the region. You've got at least 1.25, some people say almost 2 million refugees in Lebanon, which is a country of only 4 million people. And next door in Turkey and next door in Jordan, you've got probably a million each or a million plus in each. So the countries contiguous to Syria are the ones who really have the most acute refugee burden. And it's there that the United Nations is actually doing yeoman service, and where there are actually precious few funds. If you look at the statistics at this juncture, what's called the assessed needs, the estimate of how much money is required for food, plastic sheets, and on and on and on. The total for 2015 in Syria and the contiguous areas is we've got about 47% of that. In the main agency that provides food and logistics, that's the World Food Program, They're at about 37% of what they think is necessary for Syria. So we're a long way from being able to provide the assistance that lots and lots of people need. So the ones in Europe undoubtedly are in better position than the ones who remain at home. And then the people who are worst off are the 8 million who are internally displaced within Syria, where there is virtually – well, I can't say no, but there's very, very little access. And the folks are today trying to avoid cluster munitions from the regime, and then the next day from one of the 100 or so armed groups who are attacking them. So,
well, and I wonder if that's where the responsibility to protect might come in.
Yes, except at this juncture, it seems that this crisis is so far advanced, 4.5 years into this, it's not quite clear what military force could do. It seems to me you could probably create a no-fly zone if you wanted to take on the Syrian Air Force and now the Russian Air Force, who seems to be back in Syria to establish a foothold again in the Middle East. And so the costs here are so enormous. The uncertainty is so large. There is actually no one who's pushing for that I know of.
Now, as we're having this conversation, the UN is just about to welcome a number of world leaders to New York and embark on a major goal-setting project for, I think it's the coming 15 years. And this comes right on the heels of a visit to the UN by the Pope. Among the goals that the UN seems to be setting out, ending poverty and hunger in the next 15 years, which is, I mean, I don't know that anyone could argue that that's not a noble goal, but there are some who say the goals themselves and the way there are fairly vague.
This is true. It's important, I think, even for those who are skeptics about the importance of setting goals, to realize that this is actually one of the singular – I would have to say one of the singular achievements of the UN and the UN system over the last 70 years. And I think we underappreciate actually how important goal setting happens to be. With some colleagues, I did studies of goals, 50 goals set over 50 years, and to a surprising extent, we had reached or even surpassed access for girls' education, access to clean water, this kind of thing. Obviously, there are goals that are nowhere near being realized. One usually cites the goal of providing 0.7% of GDP as foreign direct assistance. There are 5 countries in the world that do that. The United States and is not the worst, but it's pretty much at the bottom of the pile here with about 0.1%. So one can say, well, that glass is really very empty. But the set of goals set in the year 2000 called the Millennium Development Goals, which were the predecessors to the ones you're referring to that will be agreed next weekend, the number was only 18 targets to be met. There were only 8 goals, which meant all of them were cooked up by UN officials to reflect an agreement that had been made by states over the course of the 1990s. They were time-bound. They were measurable. And if you look at the statistics 15 years later, actually we've made a huge amount of progress in terms of access to education, in terms of access to clean water, in terms of people who've come out of poverty. There are all kinds of problems with global statistics, including how many of these people are from China or India. But it's still it's hard to say that these were not an important set of goals, which helped organize conversations in ministries in the West and in the Global South. The Sustainable Development Goals are far more numerous. They were not brought to you by UN officials. They were brought to you by UN member states in a process that lasted 2 years. So not surprisingly, we now have 17 goals and 169 interpretive paragraphs, many of which have absolutely no way of being measured. So this is in some ways for me the kind of opposite of the MDGs, because there is – yes, we put 193 countries in a room and they came out and the survivors came up with the lowest common denominator that all could agree upon. in the list of so-called universal priorities, because it is important, these are for both North and South, there's no mention of armed conflict, the subject which we just spent 5 or 10 minutes talking through. There's no mention of really human rights except in a prefatory paragraph. So women's reproductive rights, LGBT rights, these are not there. So there are a huge number of things left on the cutting room floor because the 193 states couldn't agree to them. Most of these, I would say, are probably more important than many of the SDGs that have been agreed upon. So this is a process. We have to wait 15 years to see what will happen. But for me, the vast number of new goals means that states will be able to cherry pick. It's hard to believe that out of 169, you will not have at least done okay on 25 or 30. And the only weapon that the United Nations system has in terms of these sovereign states we discussed earlier happened to be embarrassment, naming and shaming. So I don't believe that the SDGs provide the same way of exerting leverage on member states who misbehave.
It sounds like, if nothing else, we should temper our expectations.
Mine are fairly tempered, yes.
Tom Weiss, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Tom Weiss is the Presidential Professor of Political Science at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He was in Milwaukee last week to speak to the Rotary Club and at Marquette University.